many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others, I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 13, March 28, 2011. Bilderberg to meet in Switzerland. AFP's Jim Tucker making plans to be in St. Moritz from June 9 to 12, by James P. Tucker, Jr. The shadowy group known as Bilderberg will be gathering this year for its annual meeting at the resort city of St. Moritz in southeastern Switzerland, June 9 to 12, but they will have a lot of company. St. Moritz is a short distance from Davos, the site of the regular high-priced meeting of thousands of bankers, political leaders, and other notables called the World Economic Forum. But unlike at Davos, where the press is always welcome, Bilderberg still tries to maintain absolute secrecy. Bilderberg has met in Switzerland four times over the years, but never in the same city. Normally, when their sibling in crime, the Trilateral Commission, TC, meets in North America, Bilderberg does too. This year, the TC will meet in Washington on April 8 to 10, but the Bilderbergers are avoiding the United States in what may be an effort to fool the press. Bilderberg has been called the most exclusive and secretive club in the world. To be admitted, you have to own a multinational bank, a multinational corporation, or a country. Since its first meeting in 1953, it has been attended by the top power brokers, financial minds, and world leaders. The Bilderbergers hope that part of their common agenda with the trilateralists will be accomplished by the time they meet, a U.S. invasion of Libya to generate increased Middle East turmoil so America can go to war with Iran on Israel's behalf. As has happened for several years, the Bilderbergers will blubber about how evil nationalists are blocking their efforts to achieve world government. They will order oil prices to climb so desperate Americans might be made more willing to surrender sovereignty to a world government. They will promote wars for profit and will advance the call for a world government to impose peace, as if peace can be imposed. It is ironic that Bilderberg attendees love Switzerland so much because they are poles apart politically from Switzerland, which declared itself a non-interventionist neutral country four centuries ago. It has been involved in none of the world's bloody wars since. The Bilderbergers can expect to be loudly greeted by AFP, European news outlets, and some in the U.S. independent media. In Europe, major metropolitan daily newspapers from Paris, London, and other cities give major coverage to Bilderberg. But the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times and their numerous chains will submit to muzzling because their top representatives are actually Bilderberg participants themselves. Page 2, AFP House News. Bilderberg on the menu? Bilderberger. It sounds like a glorified hamburger. I wish that were so. Unfortunately, the only things that get carved, ground up, and served on a silver platter at these meetings are the hard-working people of the world, who are nothing more than fodder for the grand designs of these financial butchers. That's right, the main course at these annual secret gatherings of the world's elite are taxpayers like you and me. All kidding aside, a Bilderberger is actually an attendee of the infamous secretive meetings of the Bilderberg Group, an illegal collusion of corporate titans, media moguls, royalty, prime ministers, central bankers, and other sordid specimens of global governance. They meet behind closed doors in fancy hotels, with the facility closed to the public and surrounded by armed guards, a clear sign of just how democratic their arrangement is. They have been meeting that way since 1954. Functioning as a global planning commission to lay down basic monetary and political policies that the nations of the world are expected to follow. Thanks to the late columnist Westbrook Pegler in the early years, and thanks to AFP's own Jim Tucker ever since, what used to be totally secret meetings are fairly well exposed, except in America. The European press is aggressive in reporting on Bilderberg. However, in the United States, many people are still not aware of the Bilderberg gathering since the long-established press blackout here remains intact. But it is weakening. As AFP's influence has spread over the years, so has the impact of Jim's on-the-scene reports on Bilderberg. Articles that show Bilderberg for what it is, a collection of fat cats who want to rule the world. In the United States, AFP remains largely alone in covering this secretive gathering. As a result, we need your help to help fly Jim and an AFP associate to the scene of the crime. This year, the Bilderbergers are evidently meeting in St. Moritz, Switzerland. To help AFP continue covering Bilderberg meetings, call 202-544-5977 and talk to Pete or Julia. To help AFP continue covering Bilderberg meetings, please see the flyer we inserted in Issue 12, or call 202-544-5977 and talk to Pete or Julia. And a final reminder, come to the Jim Tucker Tribute and Roast on Saturday, April 9th at the Capitol Skyline Hotel in Washington, D.C. There we will gather to honor Jim, his career, and especially his Bilderberg coverage, and roast him a little, too. Please call 202-544-5977 and ask for Pete. For more on this event, see the flyer inserted in this issue. News you may have missed. Seniors targeted in Wall Street scam. The March issue of AARP magazine profiles a scam now being perpetrated by Wall Street on conservative investors on Main Street. The article, called The Time Bomb in Your Nest Egg, details how financial firms are now going after fixed income investors, most of whom are retirees seeking a steady source of income. These types of securities to be on the lookout for include complex principal protected notes, reverse convertible notes, and other so-called structured products. Cut military, not Medicare. In stark contrast to policy in Washington, a majority of Americans polled in a recent survey think Congress should cut military funding in order to stop out-of-control spending, while only a quarter of respondents said Medicare and Medicaid should go under the knife. The U.S. spends more money on its armed forces than all of the rest of the world combined. If that's not bad enough, Pentagon appropriations are projected to grow sharply in the years ahead despite the floundering U.S. economy. Spreading unrest. Fearing that the growing populist unrest in the Middle East will soon spread to Saudi Arabia, the Saudi royal family has sent troops to neighboring Bahrain, a small island country that is about the size of Washington, D.C., to help quash an apparent burgeoning revolution. As AFP editors wrote in a recent emergency letter sent out to all readers, Bahrain is home to a major U.S. naval base. On March 16th, Bahraini forces used tear gas, helicopters, armored vehicles, and live ammunition to clear protesters from a square in the country's capital. Mysterious oil prices. Fluctuating oil prices have little to do with what is going on in the world. For the past 3 months, oil prices have supposedly been spiraling up due to Middle East unrest, despite the fact that the countries most affected by violent protests produce a fraction of the world's oil. Then, on March 15th, oil prices fell below $100 a barrel due to Japan's national disaster, said media wonks. Finally, according to mainstream media, oil prices rose again on March 16th because of fighting in Bahrain, a country that produces about 40,000 barrels of oil a day, a drop in the bucket compared to the world's top producers. Food prices up. The rising price of animal feed, fuel, and fertilizer have been slowly driving up prices at the grocery store for the past year. None of this is counted in the government's inflation figures because core inflation, the index the government has used since the 1990s to measure the change in consumer price index, excludes food and energy prices. Why no looting? Several U.S. media outlets were surprised to see that, following the environmental disaster in Japan, the Japanese were not out on the streets looting and rioting. As we watch the scenes of devastation, the Japanese, still culturally homogeneous, suffer in quiet dignity. Not going to do it. On the same day that Congress passed a temporary appropriations bill, which cut spending by $6 billion for the next 3 weeks, the national debt jumped by $72 billion. If Congress can cut $6 billion out of the budget every 3 weeks for the next 36 weeks, it will only save what is added to the debt in one day. It's time to repeal daylight savings time, please. Surely there must be at least one congressman with the sense enough to introduce a bill to repeal daylight savings time, DST. We look forward to the day when the legislative history of this crazy scheme can be filed away in the same drawer as the then lawful burning of witches. A few days ago, we were commanded by the ghost of Franklin Roosevelt. In 1942, he called it wartime, to run around the house setting all clocks and watches an hour ahead. And this coming fall, we'll have to do it all over again, setting the clocks back an hour. Dare we suggest that if there are some people who like this exercise, that they do it on their own and not force the more sane of us to engage in their sport? Next time you write your congressman or senator, please make the radical suggestion to him that he introduce a bill to abolish DST. At least that way, we'll know which of the 535 members are crazy and which are at least moderately sane. Willis A. Cardo. Page 4, Healthcare and the Surveillance State. Byproduct of Obamacare could be the institution of National ID Card, by Frank Whalen. The high cost of complying with the new federal health care laws, known informally as Obamacare, has been reported in detail by American Free Press. But there is another issue that is quickly becoming a hot topic. Who is going to enforce these new, complicated regulations that are being imposed on the American people? The Internal Revenue Service is slated to monitor compliance with the rules, and a proposed national ID card may be just the tool that revenuers need to be able to keep track of everyone. The Hill reported in March 2010 that the IRS will handle the increased workload to oversee, administer, and collect penalties for people who don't buy health insurance. The Capitol Hill Daily added that the Congressional Budget Office expects the IRS will need roughly $10 billion over the next 10 years and nearly 17,000 new employees to meet its new responsibilities under health reform. These are staggering figures, and one might wonder why the Obama administration would allow such a fiscal debacle to tarnish the celebratory passage of a law that has encountered some, but not necessarily enough, congressional resistance. Allowing for financial surveillance and government-sanctioned thievery is almost certainly a significant Obamacare objective. However, with some Americans even questioning the tax code's legitimacy, IRS involvement by itself doesn't guarantee revenue from all people. However, a healthcare ID card, something a lot like the well-publicized but delayed real ID card, would. In the stated interests of streamlining medical services and avoiding errors in providing them, such a card could be required for all persons, containing a person's medical history, financial history, and even their criminal history. It would also likely contain biometric information such as a fingerprint or a retinal scan, and perhaps also serve as a driver's license and passport. While it might be possible to hide from the IRS, dismiss a Social Security number, or avoid getting a driver's license, the first time someone gets sick, such a card could very well be required for treatment. Total surveillance of every person in the United States, both legally and illegally, might just be worth these astronomical costs to Big Brother. But with opt-outs and waivers continuing to arise regarding participation in the health care reform plan, a major question centers around who will actually pay for this legislation. Unions, typically a Democratic Party voting base, will get exemptions as they were promised. The Washington Examiner reports, there are 166 union benefit funds now exempted from this requirement, which account for about 40% of the exempted workers. There is also discussion about removing the individual mandate portion by allowing states to create their own health care systems. This bipartisan proposal seems to have Obama's support. However, in a December 14, 2010 article for Bloomberg, Tom Schoenberg and Margaret Fisk wrote, Justice Department lawyers in court papers called the mandatory insurance measure the cornerstone of the overhaul while attempting to block state challenges to the law. New York-based news outlet Bloomberg also stated, without payments generated from the required policies, the health insurance market would face extinction. So how is it possible to sustain such a pricey piece of legislation when the primary sources of revenue are being eroded? Compounding concerns is the number of additional qualifiers for Medicaid and those who cannot afford other options due to unemployment and poverty. Online news website Newsmax quoted Representative Michelle Bachmann, Republican, Minnesota, as saying there was a $105 billion appropriation deceitfully hidden in the health care reform legislation by Democrats. This is why Speaker Pelosi said we need to pass the bill to know what's in it, Bachmann stated. Removing the individual mandate would eliminate Mrs. Pelosi's threatened fines and jail time she proposed in her legislation. A November 2009 letter from the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation revealed, Americans who do not maintain acceptable health insurance coverage and who choose not to pay the bill's new individual mandate tax are subject to numerous civil and criminal penalties, including criminal fines of up to $250,000 and imprisonment of up to 5 years. But the costs to implement this legislation remain. NBC Connecticut revealed in October 2010 that Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield were raising their premiums nearly 50%. When Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal questioned this hike, Insurance Commissioner Thomas Sullivan told him, "These rates reflect the current cost to deliver care and the impact of more comprehensive benefit designs required under the federal health care reform law. If the Attorney General wants to complain, he should complain to Congress." In 2010, large companies stated that the health care reform bill would bring vast additional expenses on companies that continue to do business in the United States. Boeing claimed claimed its cost would be $150 million, while Caterpillar put its amount at $100 million in the first year alone. John Deere expects a $150 million increase, and AT&T expects to spend an additional $1 billion. Page 6, AFP on the New World Order. Former insider reveals Big Oil's endgame. Lindsay Williams tells why the global elite will finally allow extraction of U.S. oil and how, by Pat Shannon. 40 years ago, author Lindsay Williams served as chaplain for the oil companies that built the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline. During the 1970s, invited to sit in on highly secret meetings, Williams inadvertently learned the long-term plans regarding the Middle East and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC. The title of his noted book, The Energy Non-Crisis, a few years later highlighted Williams' whistleblowing on this matter. But what Williams has to say today may help us understand why regimes are being challenged or toppled in various countries in the growing unrest in the Middle East. According to Williams, the deal was consummated decades ago when Henry Kissinger came to terms with the Middle Eastern oil-rich nations, agreeing that the United States would make them very wealthy by buying their oil. Although the United States has enough oil in Alaska alone to last for several centuries, America would largely agree to leave it underground and produce limited amounts of oil in the United States. In return, the oil sheiks would take a portion of their oil sales income and buy U.S. debt, including Treasury securities and other paper, something Williams reported 3 decades ago. The new information that he has gone public with is that the elite are about to renege on their deal and double-cross those nations in OPEC, and it is ultimately about furtherance of the New World Order. In Williams' view, the crisis in Egypt was exacerbated by the CIA with paid agitators. And although they did not initiate the unrest, the Muslim Brotherhood is being manipulated by the elite in the crisis areas in the aftermath. The prediction is that because of the ongoing crisis and the continued decline of the dollar, oil will go to $150 and then to $200 a barrel before the year is out. When it reaches these levels, Williams says, the plan is to cease purchasing oil from the Middle East and begin extracting it from Gull Island in Alaska's Prudhoe Bay from the nearby Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, in Alaska, and from the Bakken Formation where North Dakota meets Canada. In addition, 2 trillion barrels of shale oil lying beneath the Rocky Mountains may be tapped. Such a welcome retaliation to the Arab oil czars will certainly be applauded by the American people, who will be told that it is being done to lower prices at U.S. pumps. However, when such a result never comes and gasoline prices soar to $6 a gallon anyway, the American people will realize, too late again, that the only change made has been in who harvests the vast profits. AFP has reported extensively in recent years on both the Bakken Formation and Gull Island, pointing out the practical need to tap those huge domestic oil sources, along with using biofuels, ethanol, and other alternatives, so the U.S. can become more oil independent but also rely on a variety of fuels to boost the overall economy through diversification. If Williams is correct and the end game is to bring the United States more fully into the New World Order, then much has already been accomplished toward that goal by shipping U.S. jobs and factories overseas, and by the decline of the dollar. China could conceivably replace the U.S. as the top world power, and the dollar would no longer be the world's reserve currency. Watchdog Group Forcing Fed to Reveal Secret Deals, by Jeffrey Smith. In a move that has caused a shockwave of attention and comment, a major association in the gold market has succeeded in forcing the Federal Reserve to disclose internal documents on the Fed's secret inner structure and operations. The Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, a gold market watchdog group, which has often been at the forefront of fighting official efforts to suppress the price of gold, has brought action in a Washington, D.C. federal district court, petitioning the court for some of the most closely guarded documents in the Fed's ultra-secret international gold swap program. In a recent statement, a GATA official said the court's ruling gives new hope that the Fed's enormous secret power to rig markets and bestow the fantastic patronage on a parasitic financial elite can be brought to account. The organization's actions have caused some of the most intense notice and comment in recent years. Dozens of major websites have reported news of the lawsuit, hailing the group's effort. Notice of its legal action has become widespread in gold and other hard asset circles. Several major shortwave and internet radio programs have carried the story. The group's legal actions come after months of Freedom of Information requests to the Fed, which produced only a minimum of highly blacked-out documents, after which the organization filed legal action. Recently, U.S. District Judge Ellen Siegel Havel ordered the Fed to produce sensitive information on the closely guarded gold swap program. GATA asked the court to force the Fed to reveal the secret program, even if the documents were to be viewed only by the judge in chambers or through some other limited means prior to any general release. The Fed's gold swap program consists of the privately owned and controlled central bank leasing or temporarily conveying ownership of U.S. gold to foreign banks and financial institutions, which, reportedly, allow the use of gold in foreign programs in a manner that is neither legal nor politically possible in the United States. Critics say this also has the effect of artificially suppressing the price of gold. In the case, GATA has also questioned the Vaughan Index, which is a listing provided by the Fed of what documents they possess. The Fed says it possesses perhaps 20 documents, but most Fed watchers say that the body of documents associated with this most central and important program of international wealth cooperation and transfers is much larger. GATA recently teamed up with the constitutional law firm of William J. Olson of Vienna, Virginia. Speaking from his office, Olson said that the GATA lawsuit may have some of the most far-reaching implications of any legal action involving the Fed in recent years. Indeed, GATA joins a long list of organizations and activists that have sought to expose the secret inner workings of the private bank, which controls America's currency and debt. From inside precious metal trading circles and broader patriotic circles, swift and numerous responses have been registered. Eric Winston of American Silver and Gold, one of the nation's largest gold and hard asset trading firms, called these events unprecedented and highly significant regarding a central bank that doesn't answer to anyone. Others in the hard asset field, such as Eric Cederstrom of Patriot Trading Group, said any disclosures would be very beneficial to the country by breaking the Fed's iron wall of secrecy. And, by the way, is there really any gold left in Fort Knox? Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. House Speaker proposes new plan to produce more oil domestically. With the price of crude hovering at over $100 a barrel and gasoline averaging $3.50 a gallon around the country, American voters are growing impatient with Washington and its seeming inability to rein in the out-of-control cost of energy. The mainstream media have pinned the spiraling price of oil on unrest in Libya, but Libya produces less than 2% of the global oil supply, a small amount when compared to the world's top producers. Meanwhile, the price of a barrel of oil has increased by 35% since summer 2010, when it was under $75. In the March 7th and 14th edition, American Free Press reported that the United States ranks third among the world's oil-producing nations, pumping out over 5.4 million barrels a day. Russia tops the list by a hefty margin, producing 9.5 million barrels a day, with Saudi Arabia running a close second with 8.3 million barrels a day. A new poll shows the frustration Americans have over U.S. energy policy, and a significant majority of Americans want the federal government to truly pursue a policy of energy independence by allowing more drilling in waters off the coast as well as in parts of the inland United States, such as the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve that are currently off limits. The survey conducted by Investors Business Daily found that 67% favor drilling in the waters off the coast. An additional 65% believe the United States should be tapping the vast shale oil deposits in Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. Since 1982, Congress has banned drilling in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, despite the fact that the Department of Interior's Mineral Management Service estimates that there are around 18 billion barrels of oil underwater in parts of the country that are currently no-go zones. This is in addition to the 100 billion barrels of oil where trading is allowed in the Gulf of Mexico and off the Alaskan and Southern Californian coasts. Americans use about 8 billion barrels of oil in a year. That means the United States has plenty of oil, which will last for many decades to come. But drilling in the U.S. is only part of the solution. Thankfully, both Republicans and Democrats realize this. House Republicans say they will be introducing a series of bills that encourage a broad mix of energy solutions to meet the country's demand. This includes more development of domestic oil, natural gas, solar power, and ethanol and other biofuels. When Democrats had a majority in Congress, they tried on several occasions to pass huge bills promoting energy production. The problem was the legislation always came with environmental environmental regulations such as cap and trade that were deal breakers for many in the House and Senate. House Majority Leader John Boehner, Republican Ohio, believes breaking up energy bills into smaller, more palatable measures, bite-sized chunks, could make for easier passage. Why wouldn't we have a bill to encourage vehicles to use natural gas and do it by itself? Boehner asked in a public statement. Boehner outlined a new program he called the American Energy Initiative, adding, "We will work to stop government policies that are driving up gas prices, expand American energy production to lower costs and create more jobs, and promote an all-of-the-above strategy to increase all forms of American energy. In addition, we will work with governors and state officials to identify ways we can help them increase energy production and create jobs." GOP won't raise debt ceiling without cuts. Republicans are circling the wagons when it comes to federal spending, in full knowledge that a majority in Congress can stop Democrats from continuing to rack up debt. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, clarified the GOP position in a series of March interviews. In an interview with television talk show hosts, McConnell said under no circumstances would Republicans support raising the debt ceiling without specific cuts targeting federal spending. "I don't intend to support raising the debt ceiling, and I don't believe any Senate Republicans do unless we do something important related to spending and debt," McConnell said. "It is going to have to carry something with it that the markets, foreign countries, and the American people believe is a credible effort to get a handle on spending and the debt." The debt ceiling is widely viewed as one of the biggest issues Congress will have to tackle this year. Since the legal amount Washington can borrow is determined by Congress alone, legislators have total control over how much the Treasury can borrow from private international bankers and countries like China. Since Republicans have a House majority, they have the power to stop indebting the country, so long as they can keep party members in line. The deadline is looming large. The national debt is currently $14.178 trillion. The U.S. Treasury estimates borrowing could hit the debt ceiling of $14.294 trillion sometime between April 15th and May 31st. Battle rages. Do you want tax dollars paying for abortions? Congress recently agreed to a short-term spending measure that keeps the federal government operating through early April as legislators continue to battle over spending cuts. One fight, quietly raging behind the scenes in Washington, involves taxpayers being on the hook for some $350 million in funding for Planned Parenthood. Regardless of where one stands on the abortion issue, the idea of forcing opponents to fund a facility that carries out a 250,000 abortions every year is immoral, even if abortions are only a fraction of what Planned Parenthood does for poor patients, as supporters argue. Planned Parenthood operates 850 clinics around the country, performing not only abortions but also disturbing birth control services and providing free or low-cost cancer and sexually transmitted disease screenings, etc. Critics of Planned Parenthood rightly say that when Congress originally passed the Title X Family Planning Program in 1971, the taxpayers paid for less than a quarter of the family planning clinic's budget. Fast forward 40 years, Washington now pays for more than a third of Planned Parenthood's total budget. The group's budget is more than $1 billion annually. Still, the lion's share of funding comes from private donations and from other not-for-profit charities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Buffett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Ted Turner Foundation. Why shouldn't Planned Parenthood be forced to raise its own money to stay in business? With true unemployment close to 20% and the national debt fast approaching the entire gross domestic production of the United States, cutting the federal budget should be a top priority for Congress. Hardworking taxpayers should not be forced to pay for billion-dollar organizations like Planned Parenthood when billionaires like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and George Soros can certainly afford to pick up the slack. Page 9, AFP on the global elite. Support for war on Libya gains trilat support, by James B. Tucker, Jr. The Trilateral Commission, although at times discouraged in its steady pursuit of global governance, will reportedly continue its fight to involve the United States in a war on Libya as a stepping stone to a war with Iran on Israel's behalf. That is an anticipated topic at the Commission's closed meeting April 8 to 10 in Washington, D.C. While U.S. officials keep stumping for a desired war, Iran remains, uncharacteristically, silent and even mildly amused. In previous Middle East interventions, Iran was loud with denunciations. Now the Persians appear relatively unconcerned. In beating its war drums, the White House sent a government aid team into rebel-held parts of Libya on March 10th to test the waters. Still feigning reluctance to fight, the White House had John Clapper, its director of intelligence, tell a Senate Armed Services panel that Muammar Gaddafi will prevail unless U.S. armed forces become involved. The Libyan dictator appears to be hunkering down for the duration, Clapper alleged. Lieutenant General Ronald Burgess Jr., head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, said he agrees that Libya has a military advantage and that the initiative may actually be on the regime side. National Security Advisor Thomas Donilon, in an unguarded response to a question, said, "The President is very happy with the performance of General Clapper, and we work together every single day." Senator John Kerry, Democrat, Massachusetts, called for war in a commentary in the Bilderberg-controlled Washington Post. "We need to take concrete steps now so we are prepared to implement a no-fly zone immediately if Gaddafi starts using his air power," Kerry wrote, right after Gaddafi started using his air power. Senator John McCain, Republican, Arizona, then echoed Kerry's statements. Still, these warmongers are unable to step outside a congressional hearing or leave the White House without hearing loud chants of "no more war." Page 10, AFP on the candidates. 9/11 links, big money swirl around Newt, by Michael Collins Piper. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who left office under a cloud in 1999, has pivotal political backing in elite global financial and corporate circles, and can count on friendly support from the controlled media in pursuing his aspirations for the 2012 Republican presidential nomination. Despite his efforts to portray himself as a conservative alternative to politics as usual, Gingrich is an unabashed New World Order internationalist and a long-standing advocate of destructive free trade policies and American military adventurism abroad. As such, it is no coincidence Gingrich is a longtime member of the Rockefeller Family-Financed Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, the New York-based affiliate of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the policy-making apparatus of the global empire of the Rothschild banking dynasty that is intricately intertwined with those predatory plutocrats on American soil who dominate the unconstitutional Federal Reserve System, the privately owned money monopoly Ron Paul has worked to bring into line. These facts about Gingrich point to where his real loyalties lie. Dirty money. On February 26th, the Washington Post reported Gingrich has assembled a multi-level, wide-ranging political conglomerate of his own, described as a financial empire that could prove crucial in advancing Gingrich's presidential ambitions. He has already raised more money than possible GOP primary opponents, including Sarah Palin and Mitt Romney. In addition, Gingrich controls an operation known as American Solutions for Winning the Future, a virtual private money machine that Gingrich uses to promote himself. The Post says this Gingrich venture has raised more money than any other organization of its kind nationwide, to the tune of more than $50 million. Much of it is large donations from casino, energy, and banking interests. By far the most generous backer of Gingrich is Las Vegas-based casino tycoon Sheldon Adelson, a hardline supporter of Israel who once described himself as the richest Jew in the world. Adelson has given Gingrich some $6 million over the last 4 years. Gingrich also has an unusual connection to Larry Silverstein, a controversial figure whose name has been in the forefront of the circumstances surrounding the cover-up of the 9/11 terrorist tragedy. While in Congress, Gingrich benefited from the lucrative Israeli-connected activities of his then-second wife, Marianne, who was on the payroll of the Israel Export Development Company, IEDCO, which promoted the importation into the United States of Israeli products, even as Gingrich was using his influence as a member of Congress to advance U.S.-Israeli trade. The aforementioned IEDCO was an operation run by mob-connected Silverstein, the billionaire owner of the World Trade Center towers at the time of the 9/11 tragedy, best known for his now infamous urging, "Pull it," in reference to the Trade Center's Building 7. That skyscraper was deliberately imploded, a point 9/11 researchers have documented relentlessly. Mrs. Gingrich's lucrative deal with IEDCO was cut in August 1994 after she and her husband traveled to Israel at the expense of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a lobby for Israel. Although Mrs. Gingrich took home a monthly salary of $2,500 plus commissions, she refused to disclose the size of those commissions. And while Mrs. Gingrich responded to criticisms of her sweet deal that, if I were going to get a political payoff, it would not be for the amount of money I am making, the fact is that the sums she received are precisely of the level often seen linked to political payoffs. I.E. DCO Silverstein once even admitted to the Wall Street Journal that Gingrich was one of a number of members of Congress who was lobbied to support Silverstein's company's proposals when his wife was on Silverstein's payroll. Internationalist at heart. Going back as far as 25 years, evidence was emerging that suggested that Gingrich was not the kind of Republican that could be considered traditional. A front-page exclusive published in the January 28, 1985 issue of The Spotlight revealed that, while he was then a little-known junior member of the House of Representatives, Gingrich was the brains behind a clique of internationalist Republicans who were working to scrap the GOP's historic nationalist stance in foreign policy making. Unfortunately, this honest effort to expose Gingrich's internationalist bent was greeted with a mixture of outrage and scorn by many conservatives, who were hoodwinked by the mainstream media into following the Georgia congressman's peculiar brand of leadership. Gingrich and his fellow GOP lawmakers dubbed themselves the Conservative Opportunity Society, COS. The Spotlight revealed that Gingrich, along with several other House Republicans, including Representatives Vin Weber, Minnesota, Connie Mack, Florida, and Robert Walker, Pennsylvania, had attended a secret meeting with Donald Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, and Meg Greenfield, the Post's editorial page editor. At that meeting, Gingrich and his colleagues effectively agreed to work to revamp the so-called conservative wing of the Republican Party and use their influence to push the GOP into the internationalist camp. In return, the liberal Post's power wielders agreed to give Gingrich and his colleagues widespread favorable publicity in the pages of their influential daily. Until that time, Gingrich and company had been relegated to backbench status by the media, sometimes painted as extremists and troublemakers. Gingrich and his colleagues told the Post that they would come out swinging in favor of economic sanctions against the anti-communist, pro-American regime in South Africa. This was a 180-degree reversal of the traditional conservative stand in support of South Africa and in opposition to sanctions. In no short time, they did, in fact, call for sanctions, causing syndicated columnist Pat Buchanan to comment that Gingrich and company were turncoats who were guilty of stabbing South Africa in the back. By adopting the new position, Gingrich and his COS clique had signed on with the liberal internationalists in Congress, who had been waging war against South Africa for decades. Soon, as promised, the Washington Post published a laudatory profile of Gingrich. This set the stage for many future such puff pieces, promoting Gingrich and placing him in line for his ultimate election as House Minority Whip, and then as House Speaker. Then, to the outrage of nationalist-minded Republicans, Gingrich's COS colleague, Weber, authored a prominently placed op-ed column in the Post, never permitted as a forum for GOP conservatives, which called upon the GOP to become America's new internationalist party. Ultimately, the Spotlight's world exclusive on the secret meeting between Gingrich and the Post was confirmed by the Post itself, but only after Gingrich had reached a position of influence. In short, the Spotlight's conspiracy theory, as some called it, proved to be fact. None of this surprised longtime Gingrich watchers. In 1968, when then-California Governor Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon were vying for conservative support in their respective bids for the GOP presidential nomination, Gingrich opted instead to sign on as the Southeast Regional Coordinator for their opponent, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. Later, Gingrich taught at the Rockefeller-funded Emory University in Atlanta. What he represents is reflected in the critical role played by Gingrich in railroading the sovereignty-robbing, job-exporting North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, through Congress. He rallied enough GOP votes to enable enactment, a private victory for fellow CFR member, then-President Bill Clinton. Gingrich, in fact, was almost single-handedly responsible for ensuring NAFTA's passage. On September 3, 1995, the Washington Post assured its readers that Gingrich was okay, despite criticism of Gingrich by some liberal critics. The Post rushed to his defense and pointed out in a headline that, for the ultra-right, Gingrich is just a tool of the world government plot. The Post said that anyone who glances at the Spotlight, the weekly newspaper of the far-right Liberty Lobby, knows that. Gingrich is hardly the leader of their movement. In their eyes, he is actively working to subvert it. However, the Post was careful not to mention that it was the Spotlight that first blew the whistle on the secret deal between Gingrich and the Post. According to the sarcastic and less than factual commentary by the Post, those with a paranoid bent are convinced that the Georgian is in cahoots with President Clinton, the Rockefellers, the Freemasons, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the entire Eastern establishment to abrogate the Constitution and forge a new world order under the thumb of Jewish central bankers in the United Nations. The Post smeared patriots, saying, "It is important for national opinion makers to understand the chasm between most House Republicans and the loony right." Gingrich and his GOP revolution may be controversial and provocative, but they are not the source of violent extremism. Gingrich, the centrist. Another point to keep in mind, as AFP has reported exclusively, there is evidence Gingrich may be cooperating with a high-level scheme to launch an ostensibly independent political movement in the 2012 election, a so-called centrist third party that will be used to corral grassroots opposition to the New World Order establishment. So even if Gingrich does not ultimately wind up as the GOP presidential nominee, he may have other options in the 2012 election arena. Gingrich has long history of betrayal to family and nation by Ralph Forbes. In an underwhelming announcement, former Congressman Newt Gingrich became the first officially announced unofficial GOP candidate for president in 2012. He got in early because he has lots of closet skeletons for rivals to rattle. He has the shining example of Bill Clinton, who fibbed his way through scandals until people were tired of hearing about them. Gingrich's only hope is to use the Clinton-style early hangout tactic in hopes that the shock of his being a draft-dodging serial adulterer, possibly even more so than Clinton, wears off. Here is another deceiver who would have others fight the wars while he safely wages economic and cultural war against America, this time under a banner of counterfeit conservatism. Let's look behind the facade. Gingrich first married Jackie Batley, his former high school geometry teacher. Later, while Jackie, the mother of his two daughters, was still in the hospital recovering from cancer surgery, he surprised her with a gift, divorce papers. His stated reason? She isn't young enough or pretty enough to be the president's wife. He even refused to pay Jackie's bills. She had to get a court order to keep the electricity on while she was recovering. In 1994, Gingrich also helped pass the Free Trading General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade Bill and stuck Americans with the bills in the form of lost manufacturing jobs. America has not recovered even yet. After Jackie, Gingrich wanted to marry Marianne Ginther, a congressional staffer with whom he had a long-time affair. But she wasn't the only one with whom Gingrich committed adultery. It was common knowledge that Newt was involved with other women during his first marriage to Jackie. He had girlfriends, some serious, some trivial, said Dot Cruz, his former campaign scheduler. His behavior was outlandish. Kip Carter, his former campaign treasurer, said he was walking Gingrich's daughters back from a football game one day and cut across a driveway where he saw a car in which Gingrich was having a sexual liaison with the wife of an acquaintance. By 1994, while he was plotting to become Speaker of the House, Gingrich was cheating on Marianne faithfully with Callista Bisek, a congressional aide 23 years his junior. The affair went on for some time, even while Gingrich, the moralist, was hypocritically impeaching Clinton for an affair with Monica Lewinsky. In 1994, the Israel Export Development Company hired second wife Marianne for $2,500 a month plus commissions after he announced support for a free trade zone in Israel that they were trying to build. Yet by 2000, Gingrich, having divorced Marianne, made an honorable woman out of Callista, the third Mrs. Gingrich. She apparently was young enough and pretty enough to be the president's wife. We need not delve deeper into Gingrich's degeneracy for now. Look for future installments that expose how the depraved morals of Gingrich translate into even worse corruption. For example, the $4.5 million crooked book deal with Fox media mogul Rupert Murdoch, and the hypocrisy, backstabbing, betrayal, and even treason that describes Gingrich's path to power. Why doesn't the establishment media expose him? At AFP, we cannot overlook his transgressions, because he is a public figure who chose to run for president. Gingrich and the rest of us would be better off if he withdrew, now. Page 12, AFP and Alternative Currencies. Trial begins for Liberty Dollar Chief by Victor Thorne. On March 8th, this writer interviewed Miss Heather Lewis, a young woman who drove from Ontario, California to Statesville, North Carolina, to cover the trial of Bernard von Notthaus, creator of an alternative currency known as Liberty Dollars. Miss Lewis explained that on November 17, 2007, FBI agents raided the Evansville, Indiana headquarters of von Notthaus's Liberty Services and confiscated more than 10 tons of silver, gold, platinum, palladium, and copper. This inventory of metals, valued at nearly $4 million then, and approximately $15 million today, was used to back up paper certificates held by Regional Currency Office, RCO, franchises. The feds also seized the Sunshine Mint's entire computer system. Curiously, Ms. Lewis noted that these government agents tried to shut down the company's operations a mere week after Knothouse had delivered 60,000 coins bearing Representative Ron Paul's image on them. The GOP congressman had steadily been gaining momentum, and these coins declaring Ron Paul for president would have added even more exposure to his campaign. Was the Liberty Dollar's founder targeted, at least partially, because of his support for a candidate who advocated shutting down the Federal Reserve and abolishing the Internal Revenue Service? After being charged with counterfeiting and passing medallions that supposedly resemble U.S. currency, Knothouse was arrested on June 6, 2009. At his trial, attorneys planned to subpoena as defense witnesses G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, and Representative Paul himself. Ms. Lewis feels that the Federal Reserve played a role in the Liberty Dollar's demise. Bernard von Knothouse put $10 million in circulation that competed directly with the Fed in an attempt to put them out of business, Ms. Lewis said. AFP next inquired as to what Knothouse wanted to accomplish at his trial. Ms. Lewis said, beside being found innocent, he wants the court to declare that private barter currencies are legal. The Fed can't tell us what we can trade in, Ms. Lewis continued. Let us deal with our own money. The Federal Reserve obviously sees Knothouse as a serious threat. The government's vendetta against Knothouse stretches back more than 5 years. On September 14, 2006, the U.S. Mint issued a consumer warning that the use of Liberty Dollars was illegal. In response, Liberty Services stated, "The Liberty Dollar never has claimed to be, does not claim to be, is not, and does not purport to be legal tender." Rather, Ms. Lewis reasoned, the idea behind this alternate currency is to stimulate local economies. By establishing 55 RCOs across the country and over 4,000 merchants who accepted Liberty Dollars, people were being encouraged to use these coins as currency the same way they would use traditional money. Liberty Dollars were competing directly with Fed notes. She added another element to the story. The feds were so desperate to kill the Liberty Dollar that in 2004, the FBI began an investigation by encouraging a female undercover agent to open a RCO distribution branch. This woman proceeded to attend the Liberty Dollar University for training, whereupon she was equipped with a hidden recording device, said Ms. Lewis. AFP had intended to interview Knothouse, but Judge Richard Voorhees issued a sequestration order that bars him from speaking at this time. AFP will run updates as Knothouse's trial unfolds. Page 13, AFP on freedom of speech. Peace activist beaten by Hillary's goon squad. Secretary of State looks on while former CIA analyst is brutalized in audience. By Dave Gahary. While Secretary of State Hillary Clinton robotically delivered a speech at George Washington University in our nation's capital on February 15th, ironically on the importance of the freedom to protest in the Middle East, a patriotic American decided to take a stand, literally, and protest her warmongering policies. Ray McGovern, a slightly built 71-year-old former Army captain and retired intelligence analyst for the Central Intelligence Agency for 27 years, was caught up in the crowd's applause for Mrs. Clinton's arrival on the stage and decided to stop clapping and be true to himself. Mrs. Clinton, he feels, has never run into a war that she hasn't fallen in love with. While everyone in the audience took their seats, McGovern remained standing about 12 yards away from Mrs. Clinton. He next removed his jacket to reveal a Veterans for Peace t-shirt and then turned his back to the secretary in silent protest. About 2 minutes into her speech, McGovern thought he would be allowed to get his message out as his gaze remained fixated on the back wall of the room and he was lost in swirling thought. McGovern explained in an exclusive interview with American Free Press, "I was standing there motionless, speechless, not saying a word. All Clinton could see on the back of my shirt was veteransforpeace.org. Then, without warning, I was literally blindsided, hammerlocked to the head and dragged down into the aisle. I could see Hillary speaking during this, and she didn't miss a syllable." His assailants applied two sets of handcuffs to McGovern. "I started bleeding all over the back of my pants," he said. "They put me in a police car where I bled all over the back seat. I was put in a tiny cell for the next 3.5 hours. After I got out, I went to the emergency room and had my wrists and forearms x-rayed. Technicians said I had a major hematoma and dressed my wounds. They said I had been assaulted." Although the event was packed with at least 18 news camera crews by McGovern's count, not one came over to ask him anything. "The Fourth Estate is defunct," laments McGovern. No one carried it except Fox News, and they used a very misleading heading that said, "Heckler interrupts Clinton's speech today," explained McGovern. "I wasn't heckling," he said. "I didn't say a word. I stood there with my back to the secretary, not making a motion or a word, silently, when I was set upon by two goons, lifted bodily above the four women who were sitting between me and the aisle, and dragged out of the place before I could figure out what was happening to me. The only thing I had time to say was, 'So this is America?'" McGovern was charged with disorderly conduct, but after internet coverage of the assault created a barrage of telephone calls to Mrs. Clinton at the State Department, to George Washington University, and to the District of Columbia's Police Department, all charges were dropped. If you wish to tell Secretary Clinton what you think of this matter, she can be reached at 202-647-4000. Page 14, AFP on Agribusiness. Bill Gates' Monsanto Axis of Evil, by Keith Johnson. Microsoft founder Bill Gates has undergone a variety of image reboots over the past 30 years. From boy genius to reclusive billionaire, Gates is now portrayed as the world's most generous philanthropist. With an endowment of over $33 billion, his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has become the leading private financier of global sustainability projects and healthcare programs. All of this sounds noble, but the real motivations driving Gates Foundation are far removed from that which is being offered up for public consumption. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is actually the premier funding mechanism for depopulation programs. The foundation is also an active participant in the biotech industry's brazen scheme to create a monopoly on world food supplies. In a 2010 filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation revealed that it had invested $23.1 million for 500,000 shares of stock in Monsanto, the notorious biotechnology giant whose genetically modified organisms, GMO, can be found in the vast majority of commercially produced crop seeds. Monsanto is infamously renowned as one of the most egregious polluters. For decades, its pesticides, herbicides, and synthetic growth hormones have leached vast quantities of poisonous byproducts into our food, bodies, and environment. It's a well-established fact that Monsanto, in a classic case of private interests using government's coercive powers, relies heavily on the federal government to force their bioengineered food products down the throats of the American people. Now, recently leaked U.S. diplomatic cables from 2007 reveal that the collusion to push this agenda is not just confined to the continental United States. Grassroots opposition from European activist groups has played a major role in compelling some nations to ban GMO seed products altogether or enact strict labeling guidelines. This has forced Monsanto and other biotechnology companies to seek new markets in third world nations throughout Africa and Southeast Asia. Gates has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA. Veiled as a sustainability project, the primary objective of this so-called non-profit organization is to introduce GMOs to the continent's farmers and make them just as reliant on Monsanto's products as their American counterparts. For evidence of this, look at whom Gates has employed and where his grant money has been spent. According to renowned journalist and economic researcher F. William Engdahl, the person from the Gates Foundation responsible for its work with AGRA is Dr. Robert Horsch, a 25-year Monsanto GMO veteran who was on the team that developed Monsanto's Roundup Ready GMO technologies. How did they get away with this? According to the Seattle Times, Gates donates millions of dollars in foundation grants to media organizations like ABC, PBS, NPR, The Guardian, and The New York Times, swaying journalists into protecting Gates' image as a selfless philanthropist whose projects can only be perceived as beneficial. Their effectiveness in bullying American farmers is legendary, and the nation's Jeremy Scahill suggests that Monsanto even hired the private mercenary company, Blackwater, to infiltrate and spy on activist groups. For more on GM food, see Raising More Hell, Less Corn, hardcover, 229 pages, $12.50, was $25, plus $3 shipping and handling. It is available from First Amendment Books, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call 888-699-NEWS, toll free to charge to credit card. Page 15, The Dark Side with Victor Thorne. U.S. aids abets Mexican cartels. DOJ, DHS, BATFE missteps help illegal drugs violence spread into U.S. by Victor Thorne. It has all the makings of a modern-day Iran-Contra affair, but instead of a guns-for-cocaine exchange in Central America orchestrated by rogue elements within the White House, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATFE, has been funneling thousands of weapons to Mexico's deadliest drug cartels. In recent months, Mexican drug gangs operating on the U.S. border with Mexico have been responsible for murdering U.S. ranchers and lawmen, a beheading in Chandler, Arizona, Hispanic sex slaves being transported into states such as Georgia, kidnapping children, and trafficking in human organs. Evidence now shows that the Mexican mafia responsible for these crimes has been deliberately given massive firepower by elements within the U.S. government. It is no exaggeration to say that these groups likely pose the most immediate threat facing the United States. As Pat Shannon reported in AFP's March 7-14, 2011 issue, Project Gunrunner was purportedly carried out to track cartel members. However, it now appears that the operation has facilitated the transfer of illicit narcotics across our southern border. When honest and watchful gun shop owners notified the BATFE of suspicious firearms purchases, the BATFE's hierarchy ordered its street agents to ignore the illegal gun running. Consequently, in December, Border Patrol agent Brian Terry from Michigan was shot and killed, evidently with one of the weapons that was traced back to a sale performed under Project Gunrunner. And if Terry's murder by an illegal alien on December 14th is not shocking enough, recent published reports add insult to injury by revealing that Terry was only authorized to carry a gun, which fires beanbags, while on patrol along the violent and volatile border region. The Arizona Daily Star reports that Border Patrol agents shot beanbags at a group of suspected bandits before the men returned fire during a confrontation in a remote canyon, killing Agent Terry with a single gunshot, records show. The broader blowback is that a bloodbath currently plagues some of Mexico's border cities, with the violence increasingly spilling over into the United States, where tourists, farmers, and innocent citizens have fallen prey to it. On March 3rd, veteran CBS correspondent Cheryl Atkinson interviewed disgruntled BATFE agent John Dotson, who admitted that, via another secret operation called Fast and Furious, his superiors approved a vast gun-running and drug-smuggling operation between the United States and Mexico. Dotson further insisted that this illegal enterprise, opposed by legitimate BATFE agents, was approved all the way to the top of Attorney General Eric Holder's Justice Department. In this regard, the BATFE criminally enabled a ruthless criminal enterprise, Mexico's drug cartels, to murder Americans in heavy firefights using at least some weapons that had been purchased through the BATFE's program. When Dotson objected to the practice of facilitating Mexico's mafia with illegal weapons, telling his BATFE bosses that U.S. citizens were being killed as a result, he was callously told, "If you're going to make omelets, you have to scramble some eggs." The appalling reality of this analogy is clear. The blood of Americans and Mexicans is being spilled in large amounts, but federal authorities don't care, because it's all part of an official program to monitor weapon sales and drug trafficking. But there is no doubt today that the violence that was once confined to the Mexican border region is now spreading across the United States. White House drug czar Gil Kerlikowske confided to Josh Bernstein of The Daily on March 3rd, "Mexican drug cartels are in well over 200 cities here in the United States. Will Holder and the heads of Homeland Security and the BATFE answer for their role in this treasonous endeavor?" When asked whether BATFE's participation in Project Gunrunner led to Agent Terry being slain in an Arizona desert, DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano replied publicly that the case was still under investigation. In light of her non-response, some vital questions must be asked. What did Napolitano and Holder know about Operation Gunrunner, and when did they find out about it? Senator Charles Grassley, Republican Iowa, has now initiated an investigation into the BATFE's program. So far, he has blasted DOJ for stonewalling him by denying the program despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. If their answers are not satisfactory, investigative hearings should begin immediately with the expectation that murder charges will be filed for any individual found to be responsible for this national disaster. Page 17, The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. "Israel is real black sheep of world's nuclear family," by Vince Ryan. Danny Yatom, the former director of Israel's Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations, stated at a September 12, 2010 International Institute for Counterterrorism conference that only an international military force, led by the United States, which is fighting at least two other official wars and an unknown number of undeclared operations across the globe, can stop Iran. "Since the sanctions are not enough, I am hopeful that the world will come to its senses and reach the conclusion that to stop the Iranian nuclear arms race, we will have to attack some of their nuclear facilities," the Jerusalem Post quoted him as saying. He stressed that if the world failed to meet the challenge, Israel would retain the right to self-defense. Figure it out for yourselves and what that means, he said, suggesting a form of blackmail. Either the U.S. attacks Iran or Israel will. However, it must be pointed out, it is Israel that hasn't signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel has never officially acknowledged its nuclear arms program, consisting of some 400 nuclear warheads pointed at U.S., European, and Iranian cities. But according to a New York Times story on January 15, 2011, Iran's nuclear program has suffered a major setback. The Dimona complex in the Negev, Times reported, is famous as the heavily guarded heart of Israel's never-acknowledged nuclear arms program, where neat rows of factories make atomic fuel for the arsenal, the Times noted, adding, over the past 2 years, according to intelligence and military experts familiar with its operations, Dimona has taken a new secret role as a critical testing ground in a joint American and Israeli effort to undermine Iran's efforts to make a bomb of its own. Behind Dimona's barbed wire, the experts say, Israel has spun nuclear centrifuges virtually identical to Iran's at Natanz, where Iranian scientists are struggling to enrich uranium. They say Dimona tested the effectiveness of the Stuxnet computer worm, a destructive program that appears to have wiped out roughly a fifth of Iran's nuclear centrifuges, and helped delay, though not destroy, Tehran's ability to make its first nuclear arms, the Times continued. Both the retiring chief of Israel's Mossad, Meir Dagan, and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton separately announced that Iran's efforts have been set back by several years, the newspaper added. Dagan, whom Iran blames for the death of several of its scientists, told the Israeli Knesset parliament that Iran had run into technological difficulties that could delay a bomb until 2015. That represented a sharp reversal from Israel's long-held argument that Iran was on the cusp of success, the Times went on to say. In January 2009, the Times also reported that President George W. Bush had authorized a covert program to undermine the electrical and computer systems around Natanz, Iran's major enrichment center. President Obama sped it up, and so did the Israelis. Moshe Yaalon, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, said in a radio broadcast, "A number of technological challenges and difficulties have beset Iran's program. The troubles have postponed the timetable." Despite these major setbacks to Iran's program, nuclear-armed Israel still itches to attack Iran. For more on Israel's secret nuclear weapons program and the threat it poses for the world, please see Michael Collins Piper's book, The Golem, Israel's Hellbomb, softcover, 198 pages, $25 plus $3 shipping and handling. Order from American Free Press, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003, or call toll-free 888-699-NEWS to charge. Page 18, AFP on the financial crisis. King of Con Men calls government a Ponzi scheme, by Keith Hansen. One would have to dig deep into the historical record to find a person more reviled in the public mind than Bernie Madoff, who is serving a 150-year sentence in a North Carolina federal prison for running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. Of all the epithets used to describe Madoff, most of them unprintable, pathological liar may be the most accurate. Yet much of America was seized by a comment Madoff made in a February 27th interview with New York Magazine. "The whole government," said Madoff, "is a Ponzi scheme." Why did his comment draw so much attention? Did his charge against the government strike deeply into our psyches like a dark truth we can no longer deny? Gauging the play his comment received, it appears the public realizes that Madoff is giving us the straight skinny about our government's fiscal malfeasance. He is a lifer in the penal system, and lifers have nothing to lose by telling the truth. Lawrence Kotikoff, author and professor of economics at Boston University, addressed this issue in an opinion piece he wrote in August for New York-based news outlet Bloomberg. Kotikoff, using the Congressional Budget Office's own statistics, fixed the U.S. fiscal gap, the difference between projected spending and projected revenue, at $202 trillion, more than 15 times the official debt. Without quibbling about the actual figure, it's clear the problem is enormous and could never have become such had it not been willfully ignored by both parties over a long period of time. Noted Stanford University scholar Anthony C. Sutton and co-writer Patrick Wood warned of this disastrous practice in their 1978 book Trilaterals Over Washington. "There is not a whit of practical difference between Republicans and Democrats in the basic question of fiscal probity," wrote Sutton and Wood. "Rhetoric doesn't reduce deficits. Periodically, Congress acts out a charade extending the temporary debt ceiling, a totally dishonest practice allowing them to avoid facing the issue of the federal deficit. Kotikoff echoes those sentiments. Congress has been very careful over the years to label most of its liabilities unofficial to keep them off the books and far in the future. Unfortunately, the future is here and consequences cannot be avoided. Kotikoff continued, "This is what happens when you run a massive Ponzi scheme for six decades straight, taking over larger resources from the young and giving them to the old while promising the young their eventual return at passing the generational buck." Madoff was right, and it is an ironic twist of fate that Madoff escapes the pain of the nation's profound financial mismanagement, living in government housing and food on a fixed income, neither of which is likely to face the axe should the government start chopping away at entitlements. Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant, Media Hucksters, Politicians Running Out of Snake Oil, by Jim Trafficant. The mainstream media's manipulators are about to run out of ploys to convince us that all is well, financially speaking, in these United States. The government is also running out of tricks. So, consider the following five mainstream news headlines, with short explanations, that appeared from about October 2010 through the present. Fed to purchase billions in bonds. To invigorate the economy, the Federal Reserve Board bought $600 billion worth of Treasury bonds. Stocks rally around the world after Fed action. The stock market surged after the Federal Reserve Board purchased another $600 billion in Treasury bonds. Treasury estimates $362 billion in borrowing. The Treasury Department said it needed to borrow $362 billion in the final 2010 quarter, the second largest borrowing for this quarter in history. Fannie Mae asks for $2.5 billion more aid. Fannie Mae said it lost $3.5 billion in the July-September 2010 quarter. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac estimate that it will cost the U.S. government more than $260 billion to be successfully rescued. The two loan institutions had originally estimated their additional needs to be $133 billion. Now it's $260 billion. Social Security to see $600 billion in deficits. Over the next decade, Social Security will amass over $600 billion in deficits. In 2010, Social Security will collect $45 billion less in payroll taxes than it will pay out in retirement, disability, and survivor benefits. Meanwhile, the government and the press are trying to desperately keep you and me placated so that we will continue to spend, and to accumulate more personal debt if necessary to continue buying and spending. America at this reckless pace, compounded by all this propaganda, will implode in about 20 years. The telltale sign to me is Social Security. In previous articles, I stated that there is no Social Security Trust Fund. How can there be such a fund if, in fact, Social Security taxes have been used to fund our government since the 1980s? That's right, your Social Security taxes were not set aside in a trust fund, but were used to pay the government's bills. Consider the Social Security tax. Imagine you start a business and want to provide pensions for your employees. You have 10 workers, including yourself, and you collect $100 per week from each. You then find an investment firm. You give them the $1,000 each and every week to be put into an account for your pension program, with the investment firm being the trustee. Now, the trustee absolutely cannot use any of this money for personal use, since they are bound by law to segregate these funds from all other monies. These funds can only inure to the benefit of the pension participants. But imagine that this trustee takes your $1,000 per week, goes to Las Vegas and blows it all. To boot, this trustee is actually bankrupt, surviving on pension contributions like yours. Likewise, since the 1980s, every single presidential administration has taken your Social Security taxes and used the money for something else. In other words, there is no money in that Social Security fund. Do you hear me? None. The government will deny this, but the money is gone, over $4.6 trillion. Our government is now spending an average of $1.7 trillion more than it takes in with taxes every year. The Treasury has no money, so they put more debt on our backs to cover the cost of government. Our money comes from the privately owned, for-profit Federal Reserve that brings money into existence as debt with interest attached. Moreover, within 20 years, there will be only two workers for every retiree under Social Security and Medicare. This is starting to smell like the steel industry's pension collapse. Yet, Social Security cannot borrow nor go in the hole by law. This means, folks, that Social Security is required to reduce your payments. In the best-case scenario, beneficiaries will likely to receive about half of what they were promised. And Medicare is even worse. If you still doubt it, ask why the government continues to deficit spend by more than $1.6 trillion every year, and therefore borrow $1.6 trillion more each year. And the official national debt is what, approaching $15 trillion? Remember the steel mills, and get back at me.